Roger Williams University is hosting a crisis management seminar on May 3rd at their Providence campus. Crises, whether a natural disaster, cyber attack, or financial instability, can have severe repercussions if not handled properly. This is where crisis management plays a pivotal role. Join Roger Williams MBA students and expert speakers to learn how to prepare for the unexpected. The program is totally free and open to the public. You can register online at rwu.edu/events/crisis-management-symposium.
This is the Bartholomew Town Podcast.
All right, everybody, welcome into the Bartholomew Town Podcast coverage of Rhode Island's elections. Another year of election coverage here on your podcast of record in the Ocean State, B-Town. It's Bill Bartholomew. A pleasure to have you on board today. We're going to hear from a few candidates who have primaries coming up on September 8th. We're also going to hear from Ted Nisi of WPRI. He's going to take us out to Massachusetts. We're going to talk about the Joe Kennedy, Senator Edward Markey primary that's made national headlines. But we'll kick it off today with a man who knows a thing or two about elections here in Rhode Island, political reporter for the Publix Radio, Ian Donis. All right, quickly, a couple of other things. For up to the second coverage of what's going on in Rhode Island's elections, you may follow me on Twitter and Instagram at Bill Bartholomew or join the Bartholomew Town Podcast Facebook group. And if you'd like to support the journalism, opinion, analysis, and entertainment that B-Town has become known for, head over to patreon.com/BartholomewTown. For as little as $3 a month, your contribution helps to sustain this program. Okay, today we're going to hear from a few challenger candidates. We're going to hear from Tierra Mack and Lenny Seo, who are each challenging their respective opponents in the Rhode Island Senate, as well as Dylan Conley, who is challenging Congressman James Langevin in the 2nd Congressional District. And like I mentioned, we're going to hear from Ted Nisi in the latter half of the program, talk about that Massachusetts senatorial primary. But first, the one and only Ian Donis, a little overview of what to expect going into the primary on September 8th. Here we are. It's an odd election year, to say the least. It's an odd everything year. And Rhode Island has its fair share of primary challengers, yet there really haven't been, with a few exceptions, I suppose, but there really, by and large, haven't been any debates, even virtual debates. It seems like, by and large, the challengers in any given race, whether you're talking about Lenny Seo challenging President Ruggiero, Senate President Ruggiero, or Dylan Conley challenging James Langevin, Congressman Langevin, you know, by and large, the general public may not even be aware of the fact that there are these challengers. So what's been your perspective on this election year, as unusual as it's been, and particularly from the perspective of challenger candidates?
Yeah, I think it, you know, challengers always face something of an uphill battle for various reasons. You know, there are advantages to incumbency, whether we're talking about at the state house or Congress in Washington, D.C. And challengers, you know, they often lack the kind of campaign war chest or the name recognition that incumbents have. And challengers look for more, they look to raise their profile. And I think that's been more difficult due to the pandemic. You know, I went out door knocking with a state Senate incumbent in Warwick yesterday for a story I'm working on there, you know, and his challenger is not door knocking because she has a underlying health condition that she feels puts her at a higher risk for possible infection. But she does have staffers and volunteers who are going out and door knocking. And so, you know, it's I think the challenges that always face challengers are more intense due to the pandemic. But at the same time, I think people are focusing a little more now that we are less than 2 weeks from the primary, and there are some people who have a heightened sense of comfort in getting out and door knocking with a mask and trying to maintain social distancing. So things are getting a little more intense.
What are some of the races that kind of have jumped out to you where there may be a shot, so to speak, for a challenger in spite of the fact that the name recognition may be limited? Is there anything that you're watching right now heading into the home stretch that seems like, particularly in the Democratic primaries, really, that's where this is all playing out, that may may be interesting.
Yeah, I mean, I think the focus is clearly the state Senate, where the Rhode Island Political Cooperative, the progressive group, is focusing the majority of its efforts. A number of those races are in Warwick, where Jennifer Rourke is running against the majority leader, Michael McCaffrey, a long-term incumbent who's very well known, very entrenched. Jeanine Calkin, the former senator, is running against Mark McKenney, who defeated her in 2018. And there's a four-way Democratic primary for the seat being vacated by Aaron Lynch Prada, with the co-op candidate Kendra Anderson running against three other Democrats, including Michael Mita, who's backed by the Senate leadership. On the House side, you know, there are some interesting races in Pawtucket. One race I'm very interested in is the seat held by Ray Johnston. He's being challenged by Leonola Felix, and that is expected to be a competitive race. Also in West Warwick, Patricia Serpa, the House Oversight Chair, is being challenged by a progressive candidate, Nicholas Delmonico, and I think that is a race to watch. So those are, you know, a handful of the races that I'm watching. Of course, you know, you mentioned Lenny Seo and President Ruggiero. I mean, Dominic Ruggiero has obviously taken that race seriously, even though he has a lot of advantages as an incumbent. Anytime a member of leadership has a challenge, that's worth keeping an eye on. But one thing that's hard to tell this year is just where the energy is. You know, usually legislative races, some of them are decided by a very small number of votes. And oftentimes it's the candidate who works the hardest, who gets out and knocks the most doors, who is successful. And that's been a more difficult thing to do this year because of the pandemic. So it's hard to assess in some cases who has been out there door knocking and making those kind of aggressive efforts on the ground.
Then, of course, there's also the voter side of that same energy equation. Of course, we've got all of the really bizarre situation involving the mail ballots. Of course, Dominic Ruggiero is tied into that, and it's just gotten a little bit wackier than really needs to be, even for those who are mail ballot detractors. Probably at this point, it's become sort of a runaway story. But by and large, what's your feedback? Obviously, broadcasting on the public's radio, and I mean, you reach a massive audience each week with your column. What sort of feedback have you received from just the general public? Are people paying attention this year?
Yeah, well, I think people are focused a lot more, as is always the case, on the presidential election. You know, we're in the midst of the Republican National Committee meeting this week. And I think the average person pays a lot more attention to presidential politics than to what's happening in the General Assembly. Now, of course, what's happening in the General Assembly might have a more direct impact on their lives in many ways, as far as the taxes they pay, the quality of schools, quality of the environment in Rhode Island, things like that. But, you know, generally, I think that primaries tend to be, legislative primaries tend to be a bit of an inside game where people, it's really people who just pay very close attention to politics and maybe some others who vote and follow it closely and who respond to the candidates who might be reaching out to them through door knocking or social media. But there is this kind of miasma hanging over the election this year due to the questions, you know, in many cases injected by President Trump on the integrity of the vote. I mean, I think for a long time, Americans had full faith and confidence in their elections. Now it's kind of out there in the atmosphere that, you know, and President Trump says that, you know, if he said some things like, if it's close, you know, he thinks it's going to be, he thinks it'll be a rigged election. He had said something similar in 2016. It just raises a lot more kind of cynicism about the process. And at the same time, I think Democrats nationally, they are trying, you know, during their convention, they emphasize the importance of people getting out to vote and young people who might not ordinarily vote. paying attention to the race. So it's we'll have to see how it comes out. And it was interesting because I've heard some of the legislative candidates this year describing to voters how they can go out to their local town hall or city hall now and vote early. A lot of people might not know that, but you know, if you're uncomfortable with the idea of going to a polling place on primary election day on September 8th, you can go out to your town hall or city hall and vote early. And that was something that had been championed by Secretary of State Nelly Gorbea. And I think you'll see more people utilizing that. But, you know, usually primary votes are quite a bit lower than general elections.
Does Congressman Langevin have anything to worry about? Dylan Connolly got into the game a little bit late, but he's, you know, I've seen a fair amount of signs, lawn signs. I've heard a lot of chatter on the virtual side of things, but is that something that you think is going to play out in any kind of significant way for Congressman Langevin?
Yeah, Dylan Connolly got into the race really late in June. And, you know, he's running against a 20-year incumbent in Jim Langevin, who has great name recognition, a very voter-rich base in Warwick, a lot of campaign money. So, you know, it's good for there to be competition. No one should go without a challenge. And Connolly, as I reported for the Public Radio, raised some interesting questions about Langevin's stock portfolio. Langevin has bought significantly in some Chinese stocks like Alibaba, while at the same time warning about the threat of Chinese economic espionage. So, you know, he raised a legitimate issue there. Langevin says it's listed on the New York Stock Exchange, so he thinks it's fair game. But I think just getting in when Connolly did in June makes it very difficult to run against someone with the kind of profile and resources that Langevin has. But at the same time, it's raised Dylan Connolly's profile a little bit. Perhaps that was his goal at the outset. You know, he might be setting himself up to do something else in down the road.
Last couple of areas here. So really, it's now months out, but one race to look at, it seems like it always is anyway, is District 15. We've got Barbara Ann Fenton Fung, the wife of outgoing Cranston Mayor Alan Fung, who's made a name for herself in kind of just Republican circles in general, taking on Speaker Matt Aiello. It's early. It's a lot can change between now and the primary, of course, but just in general, looking into November, is that the most significant race on the statewide level anyway that is going to happen this year?
Absolutely, it is. And it's one of the quirks of Rhode Island politics that the person who is often called the most powerful elected official in the state, the House Speaker, has to run for re-election every 2 years in his legislative district. I say his because we've never had a female speaker in Rhode Island. But yeah, I mean, Speaker Matt Aiello ascended to that office in 2014. That was 6 years ago. You know, he's had some accomplishments since then. He's also been the subject of some unflattering stories. So kind of the longer a speaker is in power, the more kind of gum that sticks to their shoes, and challengers can have more ammunition to use against them. We remember back in 2016, when Republican Steve Frias made a very close challenge to Speaker Matt Aiello. I think he lost by something like 86 votes, and Matt Aiello won only due to his heavy emphasis on mail ballots. You know, the Speaker has a lot of kind of favors that he can call in. He has a lot of campaign resources. But as you say, Barbara Ann Fenton Fung has developed her profile as a Republican activist in Rhode Island. Her husband, Mayor Fung, is well-liked in Cranston, and they've been doing some campaigning together. And the Speaker has vast influence over what happens in the General Assembly. Now, if, you know, say hypothetically, if Speaker Matt Aiello would be defeated, you know, Barbara Ann Fenton Fung would be part of a very small Republican caucus in the House. And it's, you know, maybe we would see Majority Leader Joe Shikarchi move up to become Speaker or someone else. But, you know, that would be a significant change in the power structure at the State House. But I would not underestimate Speaker Mattiello. He's, you know, there are some people who were predicting his political demise when Tsipras ran against him in 2018 and Mattiello had a more decisive victory. But of course, one very interesting angle this year is how the trial of political operative Jeff Britt is scheduled for October 5th. Britt had worked for Mattiello in 2016. And for the people out there who are unfamiliar with the details, there's some controversy about a mailer and a question of money laundering involving about $1,000 and how a supposedly independent mailer was kind of engineered by Mattiello's campaign team. And that could have unflattering consequences for Speaker Mattiello. He, you know, he is, I believe he's on the witness list for that trial. And that could put him in a tight spot in terms of questions that he might be asked about what he knew and when he knew it about those questions involving that controversial mailer in 2016. So that's a bit of a wild card as we approach the November election.
Certainly the one to watch. Ian Donis, the Public's Radio political reporter. Read his column every Friday, TGIF. And of course, his stories on thepublicsradio.org. Give him a follow on Twitter as well.
Thank you, Bill.
Discover over 200 episodes of Rhode Island's podcast of record, the Bartholomew Town Podcast, on Spotify, Apple, or wherever you get your pods. Or head over to our website, ripodcast.com. All right, let's hear from some candidates, shall we? We'll kick it off with Tierra Mack, who is challenging Senator Harold Metz in a Democratic primary in Rhode Island Senate District 6. Cool. So, all right, so you're challenging someone who is kind of the epitome of the confusion that a lot of people have when it comes to what a Democrat means, and just here in Rhode Island, where there's elements of Senator Harold Metz that are probably more reflective of conservative values, particularly on issues that he ties into religion. So kind of get into why you challenged him and where you stand relative to his positions in terms of any issue, but particularly on those issues that I just described.
Yeah, it's been, I think that's the biggest question I get. Why am I, Tierra Mack, a young queer Black woman, challenging Senator Harold Metz, who is the only current Black senator in Rhode Island? And I think a lot of it comes from ideological differences, generational differences. To have, yes, a Black man in a position of power is super important. I will not discount that. But I think it is important that we also recognize that Blackness is not a monolith. And he has consistently stood on the wrong side of issues pertaining to LGBTQ plus issues, marriage equality, solemnization of marriages right here in Rhode Island. He is actively opposed to those, not passively. He has sent people in the community letters saying that he believes that marriage is between one man and one woman who intend to reproduce. He has also stood on the wrong side of issues of choice, specifically safe legal abortion. When I was advocating at the State House last year, on the front lines of the Reproductive Privacy Act, he was vehemently opposed to the ideas that choice narratives, and abortion are issues that the Black community has to face. And yes, it is quote unquote polarizing, but healthcare, specifically safe, legal healthcare, should never be a religious issue. It should never be a polarizing issue. It should be an issue about getting folks the care that they need when they need it. And I think for all of those reasons, whether it's generational, religious, I mean, I identify as a person of faith. I grew up in a Christian church. My family, my uncle is my pastor. I went to churches right here in Rhode Island. So faith is a very important part of my life. And I can also separate that from, one, being a queer woman. And I believe that my queerness is an an intrinsic part of my faith. And then my my views on a person's right to bodily autonomy also stems from my understanding of my faith and my faith background. So for all of those reasons, I have challenged someone who has stood on the wrong side, in my opinion, and in most people's opinion, of social issues that impact the Black community, the queer community, women, and a host of other people and identities that we can't just write off any longer.
Yeah, no, that certainly jumps out as the fundamental ideological difference. But have you been able to, obviously, with the pandemic, it's been the wackiest election season and probably going back to like pre-automobiles or something. I don't know. Like it's yeah. Seems so disruptive. But have you been able to communicate not only those issues, but also your personality and kind of your energy to your potential voter base via virtual or even door knocking?
Yeah. So I have recently started door knocking, or not recently. I started door knocking at the beginning of end of June, beginning of July, when it felt a little bit safer in New England to kind of like get out there and expose myself to this virus while, like, you know, dealing with anxiety, depression, social isolation, all of those, like, you know, cute, wonderful things that we're all dealing with together during COVID-19. And I think for a lot of people, it's the idea that we need change. Senator Harold Metz has represented this district since it was created in 2004. And before that, he was a state representative from the late 80s, early 90s. So he's been in politics longer than I've been alive. And I think that is another case where people just feel the need for change. His generation and his voice have remained stagnant on progressive issues like choice, like marriage equality. And it hasn't matched the changes in this community. And I think it's time that people finally see a voice that looks different than that's relatable. For too long, politics has also been unrelatable because it's a bunch of old dudes, a bunch of old, mostly white dudes, but we can't exclude the old Black dudes either. They have also, for whatever reasons, and for a lot of social reasons, have had to assimilate to old white narratives, old political power narratives that we have to assimilate or we have to use our power in this way. And the young people who are in the streets marching every single weekend, who are fed up with a system that does not listen to Black and brown identities, to immigrant voices, to women, to queer folks, they don't see themselves in the older generation of politicians because, quite frankly, they are not seen by that group of politicians. And so I think a lot of people resonate with the idea that change is necessary. And whether or not they have voted for Senator Harold Metz in the past, or whether or not they think he's a great person, I think we have to recognize that the person is separate from the politics, always. We can't just elect our friends, because sometimes our friends are not the best people to make policies for everyone in our communities. Whether or not he's someone that you know personally, or someone that you have like encountered or have voted for 35 years, because some people have. I think it's important to recognize that it's not about his like personal shortcomings. It's about his capacity as a political leader in this moment of time, specifically during COVID-19, global conversations about race. And quite frankly, I just think we need new voices who are ready to tackle those issues head on with vivaciousness, tenacity, and a realistic lens that like, hey, y'all are not prepared to have these conversations. So hand over the torch, pass the torch to a generation that is literally screaming in the streets every single day and weekend on social media saying, we need change.
Has Senator Metz agreed to debate you at any point on online or in any capacity? Has that been an attempt? I'm sure you've made an attempt, or the campaign has made an attempt to make that happen. But from what I can tell, there's been no debate.
There has been no debate. I don't know if people can see my face. Yep.
Oh yeah, it's quite telling.
Oops. But yeah, no, I've reached out to him personally via his phone number that is on the website. I've had people who I know, I'm like, hey, like, I'm trying to reach out to him. I recently was in the streets and they're like, oh, well, I know him personally. I'm like, I'm trying to reach out to him. I was at the Washington Park Neighborhood Association, and he declined the invitation. I was just most recently at the Downtown Neighborhood Association meeting. He also did not respond to that invitation. So it's kind of been like a one-sided street. And he also only just started campaigning. Once I guess he saw that my momentum was really picking up in communities that he thought he had a strong hold on. He sent out like 3 mailers last week. And that was the first time many people have heard from him in 14 years. The first time that many people have heard from him during this whole pandemic. He also just recently launched a website and a commercial, which I'm glad he's like finally doing the work the community needs. But I think it's another example of how it is too late to show up for the community in the final hours during a global pandemic, during a campaign where people are demanding change. And whether we like it or not, that's what people are going to the polls for. They're going to the polls for change.
Last question. You're elected on September 8th, well, you win the Democratic primary on September 8th, ostensibly, you are going to be a state senator day one in January, assuming we're back, right? What's the first thing you do as a newly elected state senator?
Well, let's see what COVID-19 has to throw at us, because that could really... that could really dictate where policy. Education is really close to my heart. I know that right now we need really creative solutions to distance learning. We need one-to-one devices in every student in Rhode Island's hands. We need a robust team of educators, mental health services, and folks who are going to make distance learning work. Because our schools opening back up is only going to lead to peaks in the COVID-19 cases. It's going to extend COVID-19 well into 2021, which we're already expecting. I think there's also the issues of the housing and rent moratoriums. Based on where the virus is going, we are going to see families not being able to pay rent, pay for food for potentially a decade to come. Like, we are seeing extreme economic devastation, businesses going out. So I think moratoriums on rent is definitely something that come January 1st is going to be like top echelon of things I'm going to tackle, as well as healthcare for all. Like, we see we are in a global pandemic. We need access to healthcare. We need access to testing. We need access to a robust like program that is going to make sure that we have healthy and safe communities that are housed, that are fed, and that are like getting education and resources that they need. So it's hard to say what January brings, but I anticipate that we're still going to be dealing with education. We're still going to be dealing with housing, and we're still probably going to also be dealing with some folks who are going to be food insecure, who are still in food insecure. So probably those 3 things. But again, we'll see what COVID-19 has for us. We got to be flexible. And that's what this is definitely proven. We can't have the same old status quo, because the status quo did not work, and it's not going to take us through a global pandemic. Like, I don't know how many times I could say it, y'all, this is unprecedented. This is a global pandemic, and we cannot have the same old, same old. We need flexibility. We need new young voices. We need change. We need someone who's going to like, I hate this phrase, but I say it all the time. We need someone who's going to radically reimagine what is possible in these really tough and trying times in terms of policy, in terms of care, compassion, and empathy, and change.
All right, now we're going to head to Rhode Island Senate District 4, Providence, where Lenny Seo, a nurse, is challenging Senate President Dominic Ruggiero in a Democratic primary. Let's talk about, first of all, President Ruggiero has not agreed to debate you. What does that say about this race? What does that say to you anyway? What does that say about the president and the state of the Democratic Party here in Rhode Island?
All right. So it shows that it's business as usual for him. He avoids any responsibilities. Like, he kept the Senate shut down during the crisis. He opened it up. They pushed a budget through and then that was it. His whole focus has been on his campaign, raising money, opening up his campaign office, getting mailers out. The debate would have been actually very good, because they could have seen the choices they have and the comparison between him and I and what we believe and what we believe going forward. But as usual, he just totally ignores any confrontation or anything that would disrupt his patent. So I don't see any, I didn't expect anything.
for the voters in your district, when they go to the polls, those who, first of all, a lot of people have probably already voted by mail-in ballot, but for those that haven't submitted a mail ballot yet, for those that are going to go to the polls, what should they know? What are the key things they should know that separate you from a policy standpoint and from a personality standpoint from Dominic Ruggiero?
Okay, for the first thing, as far as the personality, they have not seen Dominic in years. I go to the doors, we talk. I've trained every single volunteer how to do it safely. We have a whole routine. We all carry hand sanitizer. We wipe down any material we're giving them. We have a whole routine. As far as going to the polls, people are taking advantage of early voting. And because they rather go when there's not that many people, and a lot of constituents are going to the polls early, and their mail-in ballots are already in for most of them. As they get them, they send them right back. Yeah. So that is very good because it'll keep us in the green zone. And that was my main concern as far as what he did with suppressing the vote on the very same day that John Lewis died. He crushed a bill that would have made it a whole percent safer for the people of Rhode Island to vote.
Yeah. Do you feel that your message has been conveyed? Obviously, you've been campaigning. I remember was certainly last year at the State House. I believe it was last year anyway, or very early this year that you announced your candidacy on the State House steps nearby the rotunda. And, you know, you kind of came out saying, hey, look, I'm here to bring not only a fresh voice, fresh face, but a fresh approach. You have a healthcare background, you know, and you're trying to apply that here in this pandemic. Obviously, that couldn't be more relevant. Do you feel like the voters understand that and understand that, look, this isn't just a situation where we're trying to vote out somebody who has been there forever or, you know, whatever it may be, but they're actually trying to embrace your policies?
Well, the main message of my policies is healthcare is an investment in every Rhode Islander. And what I'm finding is how much people in my district are hurt by the Medicaid cuts and how many people have lost their health insurance because they've lost their jobs and they're struggling. And I find that more and more as I walk through the different neighborhoods, I'm finding more and more people are on the verge of foreclosure because they've lost their jobs. And just by reaching out and being there for them and making them realize that I will fight for them, the message is coming through loud and clear. This crisis is not far from over, far, far from over. And the implications that it's going to cause as time goes on are going to just grow exponentially. That we have to reinvest in our healthcare. We have to reverse how much money is used to manage healthcare. We have to increase the Medicaid reimbursements. I know we're facing a big budget deficit, but we have to restructure the State House so that it functionally works for all the people of Rhode Island. There's a lot of work to be done, but people realize that I'm willing to do the work because I'm walking in 101 degree weather going door to door. So they realize if I'm working that hard to get their vote, I'll work that hard for them once I'm in there.
What's it been like here in the pandemic? You had a car parade, at least one of them that I remember earlier this summer. That seemed like, first of all, it seemed like a good time. Second of all, it seemed like you had a lot of support, a lot of people who were vocally behind you. They were displaying that. But the pandemic, you know, geez, what bad timing for in every context, but certainly for someone who's challenging political institutions. How has that played into your strategy? And do you feel like that's going to have a negative impact on, you know, what you've been able to do as far as getting your message out?
First of all, we used all the different social media. We used Facebook, we used Twitter, Instagram. But the car parade, believe it or not, all of a sudden organically grew on its own. We announced it on Facebook, and as we were driving through the different neighborhoods, more and more people, we thought they were just cutting into the line, started to follow us through the neighborhoods. And we needed to laugh. There's so much there is so much heartbreak right now, so many people hurting, that we needed to do something that was fun and just took you away for a little while. But Bill, crisis is what makes you. It's the crucible that makes you who you, the leader that you can be. If I can get through this crisis, if I can win this, and I'm going to win it, it'll show that I can deal with any crisis that comes at us at any time. It's a crucible. It builds you. It makes you better than who you are. And it forces you to be creative. It forces you to think about how you can achieve your goals. It is what it is. I have to work with what I have. And I'm doing it.
Last question. Day one, after, you're sworn in, you're on the Senate floor, what's the first thing you do as a newly elected senator?
Get the Medicaid reimbursements up. Get them up so that people, because more and more surgeons and more doctors are refusing people with Medicaid because the reimbursements are so low that they won't accept Medicaid patients anymore. That's my first thing I want to do, because Medicaid affects the elderly, the handicapped, foster children, ex-foster children. You're abandoning a whole group of people that depend on us to do the right thing for them. That would be my first thing, first and foremost.
Beantown listeners, if you enjoy the journalism, opinion, analysis, and entertainment that Bartholomew Town has become known for, consider becoming a Bartholomew Town insider or making as little as a $3 monthly contribution to help sustain this program. Head over to patreon.com/Bartholomew Town or click the support link wherever you're listening right now. For daily digital content, search for Bartholomew Town or me, Bill Bartholomew, on your preferred social media app. Okay, back to our coverage of the primaries coming up on September 8th. By the way, we'll be live throughout the day. You can follow on social media, on Twitter and Instagram, at Bill Bartholomew, for updates throughout the day as they come in. It didn't really seem like there was going to be much action on the federal level with respect to Congressman James Langevin and Senator Jack Reed, who are each up for re-election this year. However, this past June, Dylan Conley entered the race, challenging Congressman Langevin in the 2nd District. We'll hear from him right now. You entered the race relatively late compared to some other challenger candidates. A lot of people sometimes get in almost too early, where they get that initial press momentum and then it fizzles out and never necessarily recovers. You've sort of maintained this steady tempo, but if you could just sort of summarize, what inspired you to run for Congress and challenge Congressman Langevin?
Yeah, you know, this wasn't something I was planning on doing. It's something I felt compelled to do. The pandemic kind of really brought a lot of things to the forefront that I think have been kind of just in the background, being tolerated and ignored when they shouldn't have been. But, you know, the economic collapse combined with the rise in systemic racism, or at least the cultural focus on systemic racism, really propelled me into the race.
We've got institutional politics within the Democratic Party here in Rhode Island. There's no question about it. It goes back to the 1930s, the Bloodless Revolution, frankly, you know, and it really has never changed since then. That's been, I guess that's the case anywhere, that name recognition and so forth kind of creates a power vacuum. What's it like for you challenging someone who's been in office for 20 years, has been a household name for nearly 30 years, but then also going up against really the Democratic establishment that for nearly 100 years has been dominating the state?
Yeah, so it's been an interesting experience. There's definitely a bit of kind of like a wait your turn vibe around Rhode Island politics. And I think that's interesting because it goes against Rhode Island's ethos. When you think about the way Rhode Island was founded, you know, Roger Williams wanted to do his own thing. He didn't want to wait his turn. You know, we declared independence before the Declaration of Independence. We didn't even want to go back to the Union at first. So, you know, kind of just standing up for what you believe in is what Rhode Island's all about. And then there's sort of this political culture, though, of, you know, we'll tell you when you can do that. And I don't really believe in that. But I will say that it's a lot of fun. It's a lot of fun. You know, I don't have anyone saying you can do this or you can't do that. It's just us, our team, making our own decisions, pushing forward, speaking about what we believe in. And it's sort of like an unfiltered route. And I really enjoy it.
I feel it's pretty similar in the Rhode Island media. And I kind of confronted that right when I started this podcast. It was kind of like, all right, who's this clown? You know what I mean? What's, mm-hmm. you know, we'll get, why is he here? Mm-hmm. And it does take, you know, pushing up against the institutions. And then at some point people say, all right, it's real. So we better either embrace it or, you know, kind of like a train coming, you got to jump out of the way, you know. And I feel like your campaign has definitely gotten that momentum. I've certainly seen more street signs or more campaign signs as mm-hmm. I'm driving around. I was in Newport the other day. I'm there all the time. And I drove by like five in a row and I was like, wow, this is really gaining some momentum. I think a lot of people don't see that right now necessarily.
So it's interesting. It's been difficult to show the energy behind the campaign because it's essentially illegal to have events. And especially given my position as chairman of the Board of Licenses, I'm making sure that I'm extra careful to make sure we're following all of the guidelines to a T. And so, you know, so much of our energy is virtual. I mean, I spend about an hour or so every night responding to different emails, messages on all sorts of different social media, through the website. So it's hard for the outside world to see the momentum we've built because it exists really on my computer and not somewhere tangible.
There was one debate, David Dedakian of Eat Drink RI. It was a hyper-focused conversation and I enjoyed it, frankly, but it wasn't the debate that probably the vast majority of voters were looking for, that traditional candidate A versus candidate B. Let's lay every idea out on the table and get a feel for, you know, just those gut responses that come. You know, of course, the pandemic is a factor, but we're seeing across the board here, you know, whether it's Rhode Island political cooperative challengers or, you know, whomever, it seems like debate in Rhode Island, you can go back to really the primaries of the gubernatorial race in 2018. What has it been like to not have the opportunity to debate Congressman Langevin on a regular basis, even virtually?
So on a personal note, it's disheartening, but on a public service note, I think it's a failure to the Rhode Island people. In this moment, more than any other moment in my life, there needs to be a robust public discourse on where policy goes from here. And we've been unable to do that. You know, I'm certainly been trying very hard to book different debate opportunities. I believe the congressman has little to no interest in further debate opportunities. And I think anyone who saw the debate will see that, you know, me and my team, we're very prepared to debate. We would like to debate more. And I'm interested to see if the congressman would be willing to do another debate between now and September 8th. He agreed to at the end of our last video. And since then, I haven't heard anything from them. And I'm just trying to find a media outlet that will carry it.
It's fascinating. We had some scheduled for, you know, anecdotally scheduled for the podcast and kind of had even worked out distro partners for it on, you know, traditional media outlets. And then it sort of just fizzled away. And, you know, I know the same as I've heard from other people who work for traditional media outlets who said the same thing, you know, hey, look, it's not just you, don't feel bad about it, because we were trying to have several debates and now people are just sort of backing out. As a challenger, what else can you do to inform that those folks who are outside of the inside baseball of politics, you know, the average person, you know, the guy who plays piano in the group I play with on Wednesday nights, that, you know, he's socially aware, but he probably doesn't have a clue about what's going. He probably doesn't know that anyone's challenging Jim Langevin. What's your message to someone like that?
Yeah, you know, we've been trying to reach out via social media, and it's a bit difficult just to kind of get beyond your circle of connections in your network, but we've been doing a lot of targeted advertising, and we hope that people are starting to see the message. You know, we've got a decent chunk of feedback from those, from people that are interested in the social media content, but without a true debate in the public sector, without, you know, sort of universal media access to the conversation, I think people will be voting this year and they won't be truly informed on who they're voting for.
Yeah, that's not good at all. That's obviously the opposite of what we're all going for here. All right, last couple of questions. What's it been like for you, you know, just as a person in 2020? I mean, from, like you mentioned, the systemic racism, the systemic breakdowns. I mean, we've seen it in health equity. We've seen it in education. And we've certainly seen it in community relations with whether it's law enforcement or otherwise. What's your take on that, just overall?
You know, personally, my perspective on the world has become increasingly heightened over the last several years of my life. You know, I got married. My wife's an African-American woman from the South. We have a 19-month-old baby. And so all of the things that I've always kind of watched and been concerned about are now very real and very pressing to my immediate family. And so that kind of strikes me in a different way, and learning how to embrace a different role than I've had to embrace historically in that regard was really important. And the number one thing about the pandemic that I think people are glossing over is how real and how long the economic damage is going to be. And when I say economic damage, I'm not talking about Wall Street. I'm talking about Cranston Street. I'm talking about people trying to keep a roof over their heads, people trying to keep food on their table, people trying to get jobs. And I think the reaction I've seen so far is everyone wants to bury their head in the sand and hope it passes over. And what we need is systemic level change on how our economy functions. Anything short of that, and my neighbors are going to be struggling. I mean, personally, there was a moment during the beginning of the pandemic where we were measuring out how long we could cover our bills if all of our income stopped. And it was, you know, weeks. It was 6 or 7 weeks out. Thankfully, a good chunk of my income remained. Still have lost a very substantial amount, but I'm fine. My neighbors, I'm not sold. I don't think they're fine. I think they're really hurting, and I think it's underconsidered.
Could not agree more on that front. All right, so let's say, you know, we get to September 8th, you defeat Congressman Langevin, and at that point, you're in cruise control, frankly.
You know, I look forward to taking on the Republican candidate in this environment because the Republicans got a lot to defend right now.
Yeah. Well, let's say let's say you're elected on to Congress on the 8th, because come on, mm-hmm. in reality, mm-hmm. that's what's going to happen if the Republican is not going to win here in Rhode Island. Mm-hmm. Day one, you're sworn in, you're in D.C., hopefully in person. There's not some wacky virtual Congress next year.
True.
What's the first thing you do as an ambassador for Rhode Island and as an ambassador for the people that you spoke of broad in the United States and frankly in the world that are going to be at the bottom of that pile of rubble that is the economic collapse you speak of?
Number one thing you got to do is a monthly stimulus. I think Kamala Harris has really been articulate on this front. She's talked about $2,000 a month for all Americans. With regular stimulus, people spend it. With intermittent stimulus, people hold on to it because there's uncertainty on whether or not they're getting another check. So a regular monthly stimulus until the pandemic is over will stabilize the baseline of the economy. You also need to pivot the $600 unemployment bonus to what I call back to work share program. If you have a financial incentive for unemployment, you're really hurting workers in the long run. The Great Recession told us that long-term unemployment sustains unemployment sometimes for the rest of people's lives. A back to work share program would reduce the number of hours individuals were working per week, but the bonus would make sure they're not losing any compensation. And so we get to recreate those employment relationships that we know are really critical, and they're really hard to rebuild once they're lost.
It's fascinating how many people are going to have to rebrand themselves as far as where they go for employment. A lot of jobs may never come back. A lot of sectors may be significantly reduced in terms of person power. And, you know, I've seen that. Look, on Facebook, you see posts of people saying, hey, look, you know what? I'm not willing to retrain at the age I'm at. My job's disappeared, and now the unemployment's disappeared. I've also, by the way, lost food stamps because the $600 bonus put me above the qualifying line. And it just seems like we've got a position now where people are stuck and there isn't much incentive for people to retrain. But based on what you're saying, you know, there would be, you know, you would be able to get back into the workforce even on a part-time basis without having to fear losing your unemployment benefits if they return to that $600 a week bonus.
Yeah. So, I've had the good fortune of representing the IBEW for several years now. And one of the things that I always take away from that is how much people want to work, how important work is for their lives. And when we see really a drop in demand for labor, there's two ways to respond to that. It's to cut jobs or to cut hours. And if we cut hours, we're not really taking people's definition of self, the amount that they, you know, the amount they care about their job, you know, their value that they're providing to society, just even just a social outlet that jobs can play very often for people. There's so much about work that matters to who a person is. And I think just reducing hours as opposed to job loss is a critically important pivot for the way we consider national economic policy.
This is the Bartholomew Town Podcast.
Okay, wrapping up this episode, we're going to head out to the Bay State, which of course is a major factor in our regional conversation here in Rhode Island. We're going to head to Massachusetts for a look at one of the most interesting primary challenges going on across the country right now, Congressman Joe Kennedy, his challenge to Massachusetts Senator Ed Markey today, September 1st. Here's WPRI's Ted Nesi. You've been really on the front lines of Massachusetts politics, certainly more so than almost any other media member in Rhode Island. And obviously on the national level, the primary, Joe Kennedy challenging, Congressman Kennedy challenging Senator Markey, has made waves. And it's a fascinating race because you have two really, I guess, almost household names that are competing against each other. And you can argue that Markey is more progressive than Kennedy, and in many ways, policy-wise, that may be true. But then at the same time, Kennedy being a younger voice kind of brings that, hey, look, I'm coming in to sort of change things up, mix things up. What's your take on that race as we're now heading into the home stretch?
Yeah, well, you know, and I admit, Bill, my take has changed over and over these last couple weeks. You know, people have to remember, there's a reason Joe Kennedy jumped into this race, surprising all of us who follow Massachusetts politics, and that's Ed Markey was not seen as a particularly strong candidate. You know, he won this seat when John Kerry became Secretary of State in 2013. And before that, he'd been in Congress for decades, but representing a district up around Malden, it wasn't really well known statewide, hasn't had a big presence, I would say, until this campaign. And so I think the Kennedy people thought, you know, there's been some gripes about for years about Markey not spending enough time in Massachusetts and all that. And I think the Kennedy people thought, you know, Joe is ambitious. I know his father's always been ambitious for him. He's a former congressman too, of course. And they thought, you know what, Ed Markey, maybe if we decide we're getting into this, Ed Markey retires. So they kind of, word got out, there was a poll last summer, but the Markey was not going to roll over. And what they totally miscalculated, I think, the Kennedy people, and in fairness, I don't know how many of us political reporters saw how Markey would become a movement unto himself. I've been joking that he's managed to turn himself into a septuagenarian male AOC, which, you know, for a guy who, you gotta remember, this is a guy who, he's been in Congress since the 1970s. He voted for the Iraq War. You know, it's not like he was Bernie Sanders most of his career, right? But getting on board on the Green New Deal with AOC, and of course, having, you know, a variety of liberal policy positions over the years. One friend of mine who lives in Massachusetts said to me, you know, none of my friends knew Ed Markey, but then they Googled him and they really liked him. And that's the problem I think the Kennedy people have run into. Ed Markey has that energy around him that we've seen primary challengers from the left get in blue districts and states over and over in the last couple of years. And the Kennedy people just never had a really strong argument, maybe until recently, for why are you challenging this guy other than your own ambition? They have their case, but I think, you know, the polls are all over the map. It's hard to, I know I'm rambling a bit, but it's hard to even poll the race. I hear that on both sides from both campaigns, because you don't know what turnout's going to be. All these mail ballots, they've never done that before in Massachusetts. We saw in Rhode Island how the presidential primary going to mail ballots turnout soared for a kind of a nothing primary. We knew who the nominees would be. So there's a lot of uncertainty, but I talk to both sides. The Markey people feel enthused, confident. I wouldn't say overconfident, but they think things are trending their way. And I do think, you know, the Kennedy folks are kind of pulling out of the stops. Ethel Kennedy, Bobby Kennedy's widow, taped a video for Joe the other day. Vicky Kennedy was on the radio this morning, Tim White said, on his way in. So that's a long way to say I think Markey turned out to be a much more formidable opponent than the Kennedy team expected. And I'm nervous to make a prognostication, but if you pin me down, I think most people right now think Ed Markey might pull this off.
Yeah, I even saw Joe Kennedy pulling out the playing the Dropkick Murphys card, you know, trying to bring in let's go that way and try to woo some folks. And then, of course, there was some pushback that I saw on Twitter to that, which people were saying, oh, wait a minute now. You know, the Dropkick Murphys and that sort of Irish tradition isn't necessarily pure Boston, you know, so he kind of backed himself into another corner there potentially.
Yeah, and that's happened over and over, but I know you look at the art scene. I was fascinated. You know, I was a theater kid in high school. I wasn't necessarily a football quarterback. And I noticed when these Broadway people were going to do a fundraiser for Joe Kennedy a couple weeks back, and there was such a backlash, they had to cancel it. Yeah. So Joe Kennedy, who I've covered Joe Kennedy his whole career, the dude is a progressive. Like, yeah. You know, I know he's not all the progressives love him, but he's voted pretty liberal his whole time. He's done a lot on transgender rights. So it's not like he's running as like a conservative Democrat, but he's gotten pigeonholed as someone who's trying to take out someone who's now become a kind of a left-wing icon. And that's become really problematic for him in this environment.
It's fascinating how quickly, because I remember meeting Ed Markey, Senator Markey, in 2018 at a Sheldon Senator White House event. And like you say, he didn't jump out at the time. I wasn't like, wow, here he is. This is what, like you say, it wasn't Bernie Sanders or anything like that. And the energy around him from some of the folks who were at that event was pretty suppressed. He wasn't a rock star, to say the least. And he has quickly become, in a national context anyway, some kind of a rock star.
Bill, I think it's the most amazing political rebranding transformation I've ever seen. And I'm not trying to... I don't mean that cynically necessarily. I mean, he is the co-sponsor of the Green New Deal. So it's not like that's false, but it's just, I mean, if someone had said, oh my gosh, the youth energy around Ed Markey we're going to see in 2020 will just revolutionize math. I mean, the Kennedys, the last time, only once has one of the Kennedys lost in Massachusetts. That was Bobby lost the 1968 presidential primary, which is its own type of race anyway. Before that, you have to go back to Honey Fitz, who isn't even technically a Kennedy, but he's the grandfather of JFK, Bobby, in 1942. So, I mean, the Kennedys, they're the Kennedys. They don't usually lose in Massachusetts. So if Ed Markey pulls this off, it will be quite a feat by him and quite a strategic miscalculation by the Kennedy family.
Fascinating stuff. So that same general conversation also plays into the congressional district that Kennedy currently, as we speak right now, represents. So where does that stand? There's a competitive race, you know, and similarly, you kind of get a different flavor of the week in some ways as far as who will emerge as the new representative of that district.
Yeah, and I know you have a lot of people, a lot of Rhode Islanders listen to your podcast and all your media, Bill. And I think I've been making the case to people down here. I admit I'm from Attleboro, so that congressional district is close to my heart because it includes my hometown. But I do think it matters for Rhode Island who represents southeastern Massachusetts. You know, I just point to, I work in television. Our TV market is Providence and Bristol County, Mass, right? That's a region in a lot of ways in itself, even though there's two states involved. So, and particularly if Rhode Island loses a U.S. House seat, I think this seat could be more important to trying to do things regionally down here. So I think there's reasons for people across the border to pay attention to. But for the folks over there, I mean, it's been a very interesting race to cover, actually, just as a reporter. You know, at the peak, we had 10 or 11 candidates running in the Democratic primary. We're now down to 7. One of them dropped out just yesterday, Wednesday, before we were taping this. You know, I would say, and I've written this in my column, I think right now you have 3 strong candidates who seem to have separated a little from the pack, and that's Jesse Mermel running on a progressive platform, a woman with deep roots in Democratic politics, Jake Auchincloss, former Marine, retired Marine, I should say, Newton City Councilor, and he's running as a, you know, moderate Democrat, I would say, and all of that, though, you know, he's says he supports the Green New Deal. So again, moderate is relative in Massachusetts. And then Becky Grossman, who is another Newton City councilor, her father-in-law, Steve Grossman, people might remember he was the treasurer, ran for governor multiple times. So she knows a lot of folks too, and her family does. You know, some folks think it's coming down to Jesse versus Jake. I'm not quite there yet because I think for the same reasons as Kennedy Markey, the turnout question is so confusing. I just don't know who's going to vote. And also, you know, Bill, you can easily see that one of these people could win this race with 20% of the vote. You saw a couple of years back, people might remember the Congress seat up around Lowell in Massachusetts. There was a huge scramble in the Democratic primary, and Congresswoman Lori Tran won that with, I think, 21.7% of the vote. And now she's a member of Congress and safe for a long time, probably. So that's the other thing. You know, people down here are seeing the TV ads and the social media ads and everything because, you know, it's not going to take that many votes to win this. And then the person with that D nomination stamped on them is likely to be a safe member of Congress for quite a long time. So it's a very valuable thing. But they, you know, that race has struggled to get attention. I did a debate a couple weeks back, last week, actually, at Stonehill College. And, you know, the candidates said, some of them said to me, it was really the first time they felt like their differences had been able to come out in a forum. So there's, and it's all, we haven't talked about it, but it's all affected by the pandemic, of course, too, not being able to retail campaign and all the rest. So that one's really interesting. You also have the dynamic of all these people from Newton and Brookline, you know, very wealthy, leafy suburbs, as we always say, desperately trying to get votes down here in Attleboro, Taunton, and Fall River, right? Nobody ran from down here because they didn't think, the people who might have been strong candidates didn't think they could raise the money to compete with Newton and Brookline money. So all those dynamics are really interesting. So, you know, and especially in a year when Rhode Island doesn't have any federal races, you know, I remember, my bosses always try to look ahead, plan, you know, what do we need in the budget? What are we going to be debates? What are we going to be doing? And I remember saying them probably early summer last year, I'm pretty sure I said, like, you know, you're real quiet around here. We're not a swing state in the presidential. All the federal people seem to be in place. And I was way off on the Massachusetts side of Mars. So man, tells people what to believe about my prognostications.
Hey, thanks everybody for joining in on this overview of some of the elections taking place on primary day here in the region. Many of you may have already cast your ballot via mail-in ballot. If you haven't, maybe you're going to go out and vote on September 8th. In any case, stay with Bartholomew Town for continuing coverage of Decision 2020 all the way through November. We're going to be taking some deep dives throughout the autumn, and we look forward to having you on board for this. Remember, you can subscribe to the pod, rate and review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever else you may be listening right now. Until next time, I'm Bill Bartholomew. We'll talk soon.
This is the Bartholomew Town Podcast.